Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers. I will ask the time-honored question. What's new and exciting in your world this weekend?
Janet Yellen was quoted in the news just a couple days ago. She said...
I saw this. This is actually fascinating.
And I quote, "I was wrong about the path inflation would take." And then she goes on to talk about we're experiencing inflation that she did not anticipate. And interestingly, she did something that I've seen so many politicians do. She went on and talked about, which is correct, supply chain issues as being contributors to inflation.
The Biden administration loves alternate explanations for inflation. They
right.
love them.
Now, supply chain issues, I'll agree, are a contributing factor. I don't think they're nearly the major contributing factor, but they are a contributing factor. What she did not mention, correctly so, which politicians do mention, is corporate profits. That has nothing to do with inflation. But interestingly, she did not mention the increase in the money supply. This is the elephant in the room. The Federal Reserve has increased the money supply over the past several quarters as much as it did over the past several years. And this is the thing that contributes to inflation. So in the back of your mind, you can think of inflation, roughly speaking, as the growth rate in the money supply minus the growth rate in the economy. You and I have said before that the reason we didn't see inflation up until recently, recently being September of 2021, is that the inflation was hiding in financial markets. That's the phrase that we used.
Yeah.
If you want to unpack that, what I argue was happening is the Federal Reserve was printing this money and the money was not going into goods and services markets. Rather, people were parking it in financial markets. And this had the effect of causing stock prices to rise. Now, stock prices are not included in inflation calculations. So when we go to calculate inflation, you see, well, there's no inflation going on here. But on the other hand, the stock market's up, and that's great news. And we argued at the time, and this would have been going on a year ago, that when things calm down and people start to move that money out of financial markets into goods and services markets, you'll see two things happen. One, the stock market will top out, and two, you'll start to see some serious inflation. And lo and behold, in September 2021, we got exactly both of those things.
Yeah, what do you know?
Now, some of our listeners have taken issue with me on this topic, saying that, well, if you look at the data, you don't see a strong relationship between growth in the money supply and growth in inflation. I pulled a bunch of data, and I'm looking not at the relationship between money supply and inflation, but rather the relationship between money supply and inflation combined with the growth in stock prices. In other words, I'm asking the question, if we recalculated inflation to include stock prices, would we then see the proper relationship that as the money supply rises, you see this quasi-inflation metric rise as well? And lo and behold, that's exactly what you see. In fact, it's a one-to-one correspondence.
Wow.
The correlation isn't one, but it's a 10 percentage point increase in money supply gives you a 10 percentage point increase in this quasi-inflation measure we're talking about.
Yeah.
I throw that out there as more evidence of what you and I have been claiming for a while now, that the inflation was hiding, indeed hiding in financial markets.
And I think it's a lot simpler than that. When Yellen made her comments, my first thought was, well, if only there had been someone who could have predicted this.
Right.
This is what happens when politicians decide that their assumptions are all true.
Mm-hmm.
When they decide, well, everything I believe is definitionally true and everything everybody else believes isn't, you're going to get damaging policy coming out of that attitude every single time. You and I made this deal years ago that we go with the data. If it contradicts what we want, what we think, what we believe, that we go with the data because every position needs to be defended. And if you can't defend it, you can't keep it.
Yeah.
Now, I don't expect everybody to live that way. That's more or less our job. But I do expect people to at least give some look at the other side of an argument.
Well, who was it? I want to say it's Thomas Sowell, although it may have been Ludwig von Mises, who said, and I paraphrase badly, that you cannot convince someone of something when their livelihood depends on them not understanding it. I think that's part of what's going on here. Janet Yellen was Federal Reserve Chair, and now she's Secretary of the Treasury. She's steeped in institutions whose existence requires that there not be a strict relationship between inflation and the money supply.
I want to talk about one of the chapters in our book, Cooperation and Coercion, the gun chapter. When we wrote that chapter, I was convinced that my pro-gun in every instance attitude was exactly correct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after writing that chapter, I'm not so sure it is. Now, notice what I said. I said, I'm not so sure. There are a host of other opinions that might be at least as correct as the one I had, but I have to go where the data takes me. And the data took us in that chapter nowhere. After examining the data from every possible side, you and I concluded, and I think rightly, that there's almost nothing that we can conclude from this.
Right. In fact, the only thing that stood out was the relationship between gun ownership and suicides.
Yeah, imagine that.
But with homicides, there was no relationship there.
If we're just looking at the data and you want to derive some policy out of it, I don't think you can.
And I think this is where you've talked many times about intellectual humility.
Humility, that's right.
This is where intellectual humility becomes so important. If your goal is simply self-aggrandizement, go ahead and say what you want. But if your goal is to actually help make the world a better place or to come to know the truth better, whatever that is, you've got to be open-minded about these things. Look at the data and follow it where it goes.
When you and I are in public and we're getting peppered with questions, my answer to questions, you know, I give the best answer I can, and then you work your way down from there. And almost every time, the last thing I say is, so I really don't know.
Right. Yeah.
I know a lot, but I don't know everything. And if you don't know everything, you might not know the one thing that you really need to know.
It's funny you say that, because when I was younger and I had my sights on getting a PhD, I often thought to myself, well, I want this degree so that I know everything about something.
And good luck to you.
After I get it, I look back and I say, no, what the degree really did was to show me all the things I don't know.
And you can shave off a little corner of the intellectual world and work for 40 years on it and arrive at no conclusion.
Yeah.
It's not exactly what we would think is the dream job. But we see this inflation now. People should have known that it would be coming.
My knee-jerk reaction, if anyone's interested, is I think we're in for at least 5% inflation for the foreseeable future. And that is until we get to a point that politicians actually are delivering balanced budgets.
That's never going to happen.
And you see, this is the thing that nobody in government wants to talk about, is that the root cause of this, we talk about the increase in the money supply causing inflation, but the money supply is increasing because the Federal Reserve is having to pay for the budget deficits.
That's right. And we've got 535 members right up there in Capitol Hill, and they're out spending like a pack of drunken sailors.
Yeah.
And as long as that's true, this will keep happening.
Yep.
And that will always be true, so this will always keep happening. We are heading to Venezuela. The United States dollar will become utterly worthless as a result of all of this nonsense right here.
And here we have a bit of a disagreement. I don't think it goes that bad. I think people, and you start to see it now, they get to a point that they've had enough and they want answers, they want solutions. And at that point, somebody's going to stand up and say, look, the real problem here is government spending. We're going to have to balance the budget.
I don't think any of that is true, because when I look out my window, all I see are people saying, see, you should have voted for Trump after all. And this is not an argument.
Yeah, because if you had voted for Trump, if you had won, we would be having this exact same conversation.
No matter which party is in power, this is the answer you're going to get. And as long as that's true, you best hold on real hard.
And notice something interesting. The two parties are very happy for us to do exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
One group say, well, the problem is we didn't elect Trump. Had we elected Trump, things would be different. So next election, we elect Trump. And then they say, well, the problem is you didn't elect Biden. If you'd elected Biden, we wouldn't have this problem. And the next election, they elect Biden. And it goes back and forth. The politicians can use this so long as the problem persists. They can use it election cycle after election cycle.
And I want to talk about our neighbors to the north.
What have the Canadians done?
They did a phenomenally smart thing. Canada has temporarily decriminalized some drug possession to tackle the abuse problem that they've got. Huh. And they've decided that MDMA, opiates, not going to be prosecuted anymore. What did we know from Portugal's experiment, right? Because Portugal is an absolute experiment.
Right.
Nobody had the first idea what was going to happen when they decriminalized all drugs in Portugal. And they decided they were going to look at that as a medical issue and not a crime issue.
Right.
And by almost every account, this has been an unmitigated success. Well, that's something.
I could tell you from personal experience, I haven't done any particular studies on this.
You looking for cocaine when you went to Portugal?
No, but I walked 75 miles across Portugal through cities, through towns, rural areas, suburban areas, and I could tell you at no point did I see anybody who was laying on the sidewalk high on drugs or even doing drugs. Life was going on there in the exact same way that I would expect to find it going on here if I walked 75 miles across the state.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And the Canadians, good on them.
But they say it's temporary.
Yeah, and I think that provides the politicians just enough cover.
Well, it's interesting because I suggest there's an unintended consequence that's going to arise from this. And that is, by saying it's temporary, they're going to encourage a bunch of people who wouldn't have tried the drugs otherwise to run out and try them. Because, yeah, you know what? Let's do this while it's legal.
Yeah, keep in mind, you can't go down to the local CVS and pick some up. It doesn't change what you have to do to get the drugs. It just changes what happens to you if you get caught with them. They have a minister of mental health and addictions. Her name is Sheila Malcolmson. She says the same thing that you would find in Portugal. Substance abuse is a public health issue, not a criminal one.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fantastic. If you can take the criminal element out of the drug trade, which is what happens when these things happen, then you take crime generally out of not only the drug trade, but everywhere near the drug trade.
Right.
So if you're living in a shitty apartment complex somewhere and everybody's selling drugs in the courtyard, well, they don't have to do that anymore.
And you think we would have learned this from Prohibition.
You would think.
Because when alcohol was illegal, what did you have? You had the mob involved with it. You had shootings, people killed because they're trying to sell alcohol at the wrong place.
Yep.
Legalize it. That all goes away.
Marijuana is now legal, I think, in 32 states and D.C.
Yeah.
And what we find everywhere we look is that life goes on. People who want marijuana, they get it at a pretty good price, mostly speaking. California has, of course, screwed this up, too. But most every place else has a burgeoning weed market. And it seems to be making everybody happy, both on the seller and the buyer side. Let's just keep right on going and figure out if there is even an outer limit here. I don't think there is. I think people are more than capable of making these sorts of decisions for themselves. There will always be anecdotes that people will point to and say, see, this is why we can't do it.
Yeah, and I think that's the ultimate question. Are we adults or are we not? If we're adults, we make decisions for ourselves. And you might disagree with the decision I make, but if the decision only involves me, so what?
I want to stay right up in Canada with the foolishness of the week. Justin Trudeau, see if you can find the flaw in the logic. Trudeau points to U.S. gun violence and vows to freeze handgun sales in Canada. Quote, this is about freedom, unquote.
Wow. All kinds of problems here.
I don't even know where to start there. We're just in the headline and we're so far past stupid, I don't know what to say about this. First, why would he have anything to say about a foreign country's policies? Doesn't matter to him.
Well, more than that, why would he think that his policy is going to have any effect on gun violence in the U.S.?
He thinks it's going to have some sort of impact in Canada.
But Canada doesn't have a problem.
Oh, come on. This is Justin Trudeau. He can always find a problem.
I saw this number recently, 237 gun deaths last year in Canada.
But how many of those were suicides?
Yeah, that I don't know.
Yeah, and I don't know how Canada counts these things either.
Right.
But, you know, look, what the hell is he talking about, right? U.S. gun violence means that he has to freeze handgun sales in Canada. How, again, is this about freedom? This is about the ham-fisted use of force by the government, as it always is with these people.
To get more Anton James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com. James, you had reason recently, actually you've had reason for some time, to get hold of some serious pain medication.
Yeah.
You've been having problems getting hold of this, which has got me thinking about pain medication, drugs, this sort of thing. And it occurred to me that there is an unintended consequence of our drug war that completely slipped under my radar in all of my years of thinking about the drug war.
Right.
And that's your case. That is, when we declare war on drugs, yes, we make it harder for drug users to get hold of drugs, but we also make it harder for people who actually have legitimate need of them to get hold of them.
It's really astonishing how difficult it's become. A lot of this is because the state that I live in, Arizona, had more draconian measures woven into this than did any of the other states I've ever lived in. But I've gotten a form of this answer for years. I've had what I would call debilitating pain intermittently. So it's not every minute of every day. So I've had debilitating pain for at least 35 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time to put up with pain. That's lower back pain. But then I get a rip-snorting case of neuropathy, which is so painful when it hits that I'm incapacitated. Can't do anything.
I can attest to all of this. You and I have been working together for over 10 years now, and I've seen you go through these bouts where one day you're perfectly fine, the next day you can't get out of the chair.
Yeah, and you've seen the way my body twists over to my left side, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do about this. One of my legs is quite a lot longer than the other. It causes all kinds of problems. I mean, that's the thumbnail version of it. The long and the short of it is I can't get what I need because doctors tell me two different things. First, they say, I think you're drug seeking, to which I answer, of course I'm drug seeking. That's exactly right. What I'm doing here. I'm telling you that I have this tremendous pain, which I need you to prescribe something for me that it might be alleviated. And they don't know what to make of that, that somebody would be so completely honest about drug seeking. What the hell else would I be doing here? There's that, but then there's this other response that I get. I looked at a doctor and I said, look, I'm in such pain that suicide is starting to look like a reasonable answer to this problem. Now, you would think that that would be enough to move heaven and earth quickly.
Right.
That's a signal to explain to people how bad it really is. And he looked at me and he said, I'll never give you pain meds. They're a pain in my ass.
Whoa.
And I said, excuse me, friend, they're a pain in my ass. And he just shook his head. He said, no.
Huh.
The blanket answer, no matter what, never going to give them to me.
Just no. Is that because he just doesn't like giving them out or your particular case?
As he explained it, it was because the state of Arizona and his insurance make it so difficult for him to even think about prescribing these things that he has to throw his hands up in the air and say, no, I won't do it.
That's astounding.
Believe me, I've become quite conversant in Arizona prescription law, which seems like it shouldn't be a thing, but very clearly is. Here, for whatever the reason, I don't know which genius got it in his head to make this the case, you can, in fact, get pain meds from a GP. And I got one when my finger became very infected and we had to cut it open in the doctor's office and bleed it out. And it was a profoundly painful experience. And he was able to give me, I think, 2 days worth.
And that's it.
That was it. So they can make these emergency prescriptions, but nothing approaching even the medium or long term. And that's really quite ridiculous. And I asked, I said, all right, well, what do I have to do to deal with this? And you have to go to a pain clinic. Only there can they prescribe drugs for pain. They've literally taken it out of the hands of almost every doctor in the state. And here's where it gets real fun, because I can afford to go to the pain clinic. It's not cheap. I'm out of pocket on it. But it's not so expensive I wouldn't do it. Now, there are a lot of people who have exactly the same amount of pain I do who can't say what I just said.
So are you telling me insurance does not cover the pain clinic?
insurance makes it very difficult for other doctors to prescribe, it becomes a malpractice issue.
Right.
Because what if somebody gets addicted to what you're giving them? My answer to that question was, I don't care if I'm addicted as long as I don't feel any pain.
Right. Being addicted is actually the lesser evil.
Yeah. These are pills. You put them in your mouth, you swallow them, and you feel better. If there's an addiction problem, I don't give a rat's ass.
Mm-hmm.
Now, put it in perspective. When every doctor told me no, I thought, well, I've got a few choices here. They're all bad, but what are my options? And as an economist, you'll understand this. One door closes, you have to look at all the other doors. And I thought, well, I could start drinking. If you drink enough, you know, you're not going to feel a damn thing.
Right.
It's going to ruin your life in a number of other ways.
Other ways,
but,
right.
But what's the trade-off? Are you willing to make the trade? And the pain was so bad that I would say, yeah, I'd make that trade.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had a drink in, what, 15, 20 years?
Yeah.
Something like that. I don't think you've ever seen me with a drink in my hand.
Well, for all the time we have spent together, once, and I think it was 8 years ago, you had one beer with me. And
yeah,
that's it.
That sounds right. And I didn't quit for any exalted reason. I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and it was easy to just take alcohol off my plate.
Mm-hmm.
The second option, which I think is not nearly as good as the first, was to go out on the road here and get heroin. Now, heroin is completely addictive. It'll ruin your life. But if you're in enough pain, your life's already ruined.
Already, yeah.
Right? So it's an opioid. It's the thing that they tell me I can't have here. Probably it would have a very, very big effect on pain. But look at all the other things that come with it, and it's pretty grim. Apart from that, I think we're back to suicide again. But these are the three options if you can't get the pain meds. And the pain meds are so easy to get almost everywhere else that I don't really understand what the problem is.
This is something that's unique to Arizona.
Well, it's not exactly unique to Arizona. Other states are pulling this too. But when I live in Pennsylvania, not more than 5 miles from where you live, my doctor prescribed Percocets to me 100 at a time. And he said, call back when you need more.
Mm-hmm.
And when my back would flip and I would be immobile, I would take a bunch. When I healed, I would stop, right? This is what reasonable people do. I've just described what everybody does with aspirin.
Right.
You don't take more and more aspirin every day. You take it for what you need it for. And is there some possibility that people will abuse these things? Yeah, of course there is. Their abuse of painkillers is not my problem. My problem is pain.
And when we pass laws to prevent them from getting hold of the drugs that will cause them to become addicted, we also make it harder for you.
Yeah, almost impossible, actually. Yeah. When I finally finished up at the pain clinic and the guy told me, yep, you're a classic case of what we do, I didn't know what to do next. I thought, am I supposed to hug him now?
That's a frightening thought.
I've been trying to get somebody to listen to me for 7 years because they don't take a very big view of this in Utah, where I lived prior to Arizona either. In order to keep painkillers from the hands of people who would abuse it, you take them out of everybody's hands. That point of contact with your GP, that's where the most information is shared. That's where people know what's best for you. Because you're there and your doctor is there. And the two of you are supposed to be able to converse about what your needs are. And the legislature said, nope, that's not for you. And that was the end of the story. I don't understand how people can live with themselves if that's their goal. If people want to abuse things, go right ahead. I think these things should be over the counter. I mean, everybody's smart enough to figure out what they need. And if you abuse it, fine, abuse it. It's not to us to determine how everybody should live at every moment of every day.
I don't know where I would go to find data on this, but I would imagine that a majority of people who are addictive like that can get hold of it anyway. And so all the law actually ends up doing is keeping them away from you.
I mean, that's always right, isn't it? It's always the law-abiding people who get screwed over by these blanket laws.
Yeah.
You would think that were I a medical doctor and somebody came limping into my office and I had a prescription pad and I knew what would help, I would just give it to him. Sorry, here you go. Call if you need more. And there's really none of that where we are now. Our governor, Doug Ducey, did sign a bill about 2 weeks ago. He signed it like 3 days before I went to the pain clinic, which might have had a bearing on what happened to me there. But he finally signed off on a bill that will allow doctors to prescribe for people with chronic pain. So if you're in a busload of pain and you're going to be for the rest of your days, different rules apply to you, which I think is very, very reasonable.
Sure.
Now, he had signed that before I went to my GP, who told me it was too big a pain in his ass. That's an emphatic answer that I don't like, but I could always go find a new doctor, I guess. So where do we go from here is the interesting question. I think it's probably time to start asking serious questions about what the federal government is doing with drugs at all. We should look at what the states are doing, because I think almost all of these things are not under the purview of government, rightly speaking. Government frequently takes things under its control. That doesn't mean it should be there. And I can't make a single positive case for why drugs of any kind are a federal issue. And if everybody's out there wincing at what I just said, think about what we now see with marijuana. Life goes on the exact same way. People make their decisions and then they live with the consequences of those decisions for both good and ill.
Well, you opened up talking about Portugal decriminalizing all drugs and what an interesting experiment that was. We can't conduct an experiment like that here because we don't let the states make their own decisions on these matters. The federal government makes it blanket for everybody. And if it happens to be a good decision, that's great. But if it's a bad decision, it's horrible, and we're not aware it's horrible because we can't see alternatives.
I think that's right. And the very, very interesting thing here is to actually think about marijuana, because now we do have experiments.
We have them only because the states said, forget it, federal government, we're going to do what we want.
That's exactly right, because come to find out, this is a lucrative market and you tax the hell out of it. But that's for another day. You've got a number of states with different answers. Some have no marijuana legalization whatsoever. Some have only medical, no recreational. Some have medical and recreational. When you start comparing cases, you don't see anything terrible popping off the page.
Right.
Now, there may be something deep in the data that we'll find and deal with later, but there's nothing on the surface of things that leads anybody to believe this is a real problem. Yet, for decades, the federal government has said that it's more dangerous than heroin. Look at how things sit on the federal schedules of drugs. There is no way to say what I just said with a straight face.
And it turns out that the greatest danger was the federal government itself. Because the worst thing that happens to you is not the marijuana. It's getting caught with it and being thrown in jail.
I remember the day, and this, I think, will explain a lot about my attitudes on these things. We were having dinner, and my oldest daughter said, what would you do if you found marijuana in my room? And I said, when's the last time I've been in your room? I never go there. That's your space. And she said, yeah, I guess that's right. But what would you do if you found it? And I said, I would smoke it all. And she thought that was kind of funny. And I said, you know, if you're really interested, there's some right over there. And I pointed right at my humidor where I kept a small bottle of weed. All of the children looked at it. And nobody ever asked about it again. They never touched it. They never wanted it.
Right.
You demystify these things and you find that people behave in very, very predictable ways.
Yeah, they make reasonable choices.
They really do.
Those that don't make reasonable choices, well, they weren't going to make reasonable choices anyway, regardless of what your laws are.
That's exactly right. And I took it as a given that they were raised reasonably well, that that was the outcome of this discussion. After I said it, they never bothered with it again, right? It was not funny anymore. Now, do I think they've ever tried it? Yeah, probably. I think the oldest one, maybe. Do I care? No, not especially. I would far rather see anybody dealing with weed than with whiskey. Think about the unintended consequences of prohibition that way. The whiskeys of the world bring out the worst in people. And if we're going to ban anything, we should start there, I suspect. That's all the time we've got this week. I guess people can say I'll go over to the house and find James's humidor and take all his weed, but alas, I don't have any anymore. That ship has sailed. Between now and next week, you can find me and Ant on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. You can
send us email, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Yep, you can do that. I wish you wouldn't, but you can. And for crying out loud, be nice to each other. Think of yourself as a weed smoker. Because the weed smokers are never bad people. They're always happy. They might be quite useless, but they're happy enough. They tend to be nice to each other, and you should too. So, Ant, have a great week.
See you next week, James.